Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to Creative Control. While I have you here, please consider supporting Youth Empowerment and Support Services, otherwise known as YES. Based in Edmonton, Alberta, YES provides immediate and low-barrier overnight and day shelter, temporary supportive housing, and individualized wraparound supports for young people aged 15 to 24. They work collaboratively within a network of care focused on the prevention of youth homelessness by providing youth with the necessary supports to stabilize their housing, improve their well-being, build life skills, connect with community, and avoid re-entry into homelessness. Learn more about how to donate or otherwise support YES by visiting yess.org.
This is Dmitry Samarov from Chicago, Illinois. And I love listening to Vish Khanna's Creative Control because whether he's talking to a favorite musician or actor of mine or someone I've never heard of, it's as if he's introducing me to a new friend. And the way things are going, couldn't you use a new friend? Listen now.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today.
Ian Reid is a celebrated and distinctive author based in Kingston, Ontario. After the publication of two nonfiction works, Reid wrote his remarkable, suspenseful 2016 debut novel, I'm Thinking of Ending Things, which was adapted into an acclaimed film for Netflix by Oscar winner Charlie Kaufman. His follow-up work, 2018's Foe, is another chilling, genre-bending exploration of interpersonal dynamics. And it, too, has been adapted into a film starring Saoirse Ronan, which will be released in the near future. Reid's latest work of fiction is We Spread, a haunting meditation on aging, art, mortality, and perception, which was published by Scout Press on September 27th, 2022. Ian returns to this show for an extended conversation about We Spread and what inspired it, how we perceive senior citizens, and how they may perceive the world around them. how his work has been categorized and what he makes of genre signifiers, how his real life makes it into his fantastical novels, ageism and obsessions with staying young, the state of the Canadian book industry, and the good fortune that he himself has enjoyed, the band Weird Nightmare, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network, with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, respectively, in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario. And with a special appearance by a dog named Della, this is episode 719 of Creative Control, featuring the lovely and talented Ian Reed, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Ian. How you doing?
I'm doing very well, Vish. Nice to see you. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. It's nice to see you again. Thanks for being back on the show. I can't wait to talk about another brilliant, disturbing thing you made. I will say that, if you don't mind me saying so. First of all, though, where in the world are you today?
I'm sitting in Kingston, Ontario, with my dog, and there was just a lawnmower near us, and that always kind of throws her for a loop. So I apologize on her behalf if you hear her in the background, but she will settle. It's a nice day here. I think so. Both of us are happy to be outside. I think this time of year, there's always an urgency to work and read and spend as much time outside as possible. So that's why today I'm talking to you outside, because I know in a matter of weeks that probably will be unlikely. So it's nice to be here. It's a beautiful sunny day, it's just good to be back chatting with you.
Well, I appreciate all that context. For those listening around the world, that was a very Canadian answer. We are very seasonally dependent, and as we're speaking, it's the fall. It's the beginning of fall. I can't even believe it. It feels like summer still. So no, yes. And don't mind the dog. Is the dog upset at the lawnmower because of the noise, or some sort of territorial thing because they think the grass is there, the lawn is their own thing?
It's a little bit of both. I think she's territorial, but also the louder the intruder, the more vehement she becomes. So even a small, if she notices a squirrel, say, in a neighboring field, she may react to that. But because the lawnmower draws so much attention to itself, she is going to react to that no matter what. So it's a little bit of both. It's a little bit of the sound, a little bit of territorial. She always eventually calms down again. So
yeah,
right now, a little bit of quiet. So we'll see if that lasts.
We'll see what happens. It'll depend on how bad my questions are. I think that might...
She'll be the arbiter. Yeah.
I think so. She'll be like, no, I don't know. That's a dumb one. No, anyway,
move on.
That's great. That's what every bark means. I wrap it up. Let's next thing.
She's my publicist, basically. Yeah.
She's the producer.
Producer,
your dog's
exactly.
Like a podcast producer. Yeah. Again, congratulations on the book. I'll just, those listening can't see this, but I'm going to hold up a copy of my book like we're on a TV talk show. I've got We Spread here. And it's another brilliant thing, as I say, disturbing on some level. Let's begin with you and your words about this book. Can you summarize the action of this book for those who haven't encountered it yet? And then we'll get to maybe my who, what, where, when, why, and how in the hell series of questions. But can you first summarize it for those listening?
Yeah, for sure. I think I've always had a bit of a hard time doing that with all of my books. You know, early in meetings with the publisher, there's moments or times, I guess, when that topic comes up. How are we going to describe this book? Or even when you're writing the copy for the back jacket. And I think my preference, if I had my druthers, I guess I would leave the back blank. You know, I typically like to go into a book without knowing anything. I know that's unrealistic, and I know publishers can't do that. So it's always a bit of a compromise for me to say, okay, here's what I'm comfortable saying on the back without, because I would like people to go into it in a way knowing as little as possible. So all that being said, the way I would sort of describe we spread is it's a story about an artist, a woman named Penny, who is elderly and living alone, and an event at her apartment where she has lived for many, many years causes her to have to move into a long-term care facility. And then the story, I would say, evolves from there. So
that is a very fair and succinct way of putting it. I will say these things to you. Number one, I like to ask authors what they are willing to divulge in summarizing the story, because I'm very mindful of spoiling things. As someone who has read the book, I'm in my second time through the book right now. And and as a result of this, rereading part one, I'm like, oh, shit. Okay. Now I see where I went there the first time. The point of this, though, is I think in your case in particular, the kinds of books you write, that blank slate at the back that you describe is really important, because you are in the realms of suspense. And I think misdirection is probably a fair way of – is that a fair way of describing parts of what
you
do?
I think so. I would say it's unintentional misdirection, because, you know, and this is maybe relevant for – I don't want to hijack the question, but, you know, I think sometimes I will see this book or even my other two novels called thrillers or psychological thrillers, and I actually don't think of them that way. That's not how I said it. That's sort of not what I set out to write. And I always think, you know, psychological thrillers is a very particular genre. And I read those books. I know what they are. And I think if someone came to this book expecting that, they would be disappointed, I think, because they offer something slightly different. I do think probably, again, not even, I don't plan this out, but there are elements of various genres in this book. And I think, you know, there is suspense. It can be unsettling at times, surreal. But I think, you know, similar to say music, if you had like a slide guitar in a song, is it immediately now a country album?
Probably
not, you know. And but it's like trying to take pieces of things that I think are interesting and I think are relevant. And I also think I don't mind if people read it a particular way. So if a reader picks it up and by the end of the book they think, oh, this is I read this as a psychological thriller, I have no problem with that. I'm always just a little bit more leery, I think, of if, let's say, a bookstore puts it in that section, or if just because, again, I think that promises something that maybe it isn't. But definitely I think there are elements of that genre in the story, I don't write with an outline, and I don't plan out elements of the story. It's more I get an idea of an image, I get an image, or I get a question in my head, and then I just kind of start writing. And you know, maybe at some point an image might take me down a path that is pure comedic or something. But in these first three novels I've written, it does seem to take me down a path that is a little more unsettling. And really, I'm just trying to get at some questions that I find interesting.
I think genre signifiers are often applied by other people to things for their own grounding. It can sometimes reveal that they don't they don't actually know what it is. So they just need a foothold.
Yeah.
So they'll, like, I, as you're speaking,
that's right.
As you're speaking, I grabbed. So what I have here is what they call in the biz an ARC. An advanced reading copy.
Yes.
So as you were speaking, I'm like, huh, I wonder how they framed the book on the back. You know, they'll usually write some sort of genre thing. Fiction.
Yeah.
That's all it says. Yeah. It just says fiction.
Exactly.
That's great.
And I'm happy with that. I think, you know, that is obviously the most broad term that you could apply to it. And that's, so I am more comfortable with that than any particular genre, you know, be it horror or, the publisher has called it philosophical suspense, and you know, I understand that too. Or, you know, with Foe, my last book, there were some sci-fi elements, and so I kind of don't mind how readers interpret that, or how, if they discuss that, but it's more, I think, if you sent the book to someone like yourself, or, and if you said, okay, here's a thriller, or say a reviewer, and you said, here's a thriller, they're going to expect something else. And I feel like I've, especially with my first two books, I would come across reviews sometimes, and it seemed like the reviewer was only thinking of a thriller when they read it, and so it sort of didn't seem like the best way to go into the book with that in that context. I think if you come to that by the end, that, you know, again, that's valid. That's however any reader, you know, interprets it. I'm happy with. So, but I think going into it, the more open, the more broad, the better, basically. So if just fiction, and it's definitely fiction, then I'm happy with
that. No, I can appreciate that. So as someone who's read your previous works, I get the book in the mail. I'm like, uh-oh, here we go. Because I've read your other books, so I kind of, you have become, I appreciate what you're saying. You don't have an outline. I want to ask you in a moment about whether or not you have characters in mind when you have that image you describe, that idea, that glimmer of a thing, but you don't outline it. I want to talk about the character development in just a moment. Because it's like, wait a minute, was it you, Ian, that you don't really edit? You just sort of go and you don't really second guess yourself? Was that you and I that had that talk?
Well, I it's possible. I think when I'm writing a first draft, I try not to edit myself at all.
You just go.
Because that's a very particular stage. Yeah, just go and try and get that first draft down. And that's also the hardest part of the process for me, is that first draft. I think because I'm starting with very little, sometimes just an image, or sometimes just an idea or a question. And it has to be enough, obviously, that intrigues me or excites me. And then I follow that path by writing about it. And sometimes that'll peter out and it will lead nowhere, and I put that aside. And other times, like in the case of We Spread, it builds momentum and carries on.
Yeah,
and
so
then I discover things. So that first draft is basically just getting it down.
Where I'm coming from, because you just said discover there too. I think that you have maybe this outlook that I hadn't really considered before, which is a bit of verite thing, maybe, like, you rely on your instincts to create these worlds, I think. And as a result, you're even getting a first impression of your own work as you're going. Like, I'm not trying to make it seem like you're having an out-of-body experience or something weird, but I feel like you would hope that the readers are coming to your work, and you're still relatively young. You're very successful as far as I can tell. Like, you know, your work has resonated, but you're still kind of a name that's still getting out there. I think that's probably fair to say.
Yeah.
So you have the good fortune. Absolutely. You have the good fortune of a lot of people coming to you and your work with nothing, almost no context. It's because
which I love.
That's great. And it seems to me that that's something you really count on, is people using, not knowing, developing first impressions as they go. The same way you tend to create a little bit. Is that a way of tying it all together?
That's a really good way to look at it. I think that's how I feel as I'm writing it. If I feel surprised as I'm going, or if I go down into a direction I'm not expecting, it's a great feeling. And I think that then is in the work too, for someone reading it. Hopefully they'll feel that surprise too. That's one of the reasons why I don't like to plan out too much, because if you set out and start planning, yes, you have that comfort of a map to start with, but then you end up staying on course and you don't veer off, you don't find new things. And as I'm writing, that's what I find most enjoyable, are those moments of surprise. And they really do feel like discoveries. It feels like I'm discovering something, not that I'm making something up. And that sounds silly maybe, but it does feel that way. And especially as you get farther along in the draft, and then pieces start to shift and they start to link and you see them coming together. So not just character development, but actually pieces of the story and plot and metaphor, they all start to kind of, when something's working, you know, it starts to come together. And I really enjoy that. And that's why I wouldn't give that up by ever trying to plan a story in too much detail.
No, and I, as a reader, I appreciate, as you can tell, I'm trying to be ginger about what we even reveal to people. I want people to read the thing, but I do think it's worth exploring some of the background and impulses, that vision. So we have alluded to your novels. We've alluded to I'm Thinking of Ending Things and Foe, and now We Spread. That's not it though for you. What was the first, and it's not even the, as I recall, what was the first thing you wrote?
I'd written two books of nonfiction before my novels, and both of them were, I guess small kind of gentle memoirs, humorous, if you think they are, maybe. That was kind of the attempt. Kind of humorous, maybe, you know, my, like in a culinary analogy, maybe something like mac and cheese, like kind of comfort food that you can go to if you're tired or feeling maybe a little down.
Yes.
The first one was about being kind of in my mid-20s, and after kind of doing various jobs, I ended up getting a little radio job in Ottawa to work at CBC Radio to review old books. Very minor, you know, 5:30 in the morning type thing. No one's listening. 15-minute spot, kind of. But I was excited by that, so I took it. And when I came back, when I returned to Ottawa, I didn't have anywhere to live and was not making a lot of money with, predictably, with that job. So I asked my parents if I could come back to their farm for a couple of weeks and live while I figured things out where I'd go next. And they said yes. And then it, you know, eventually turned into a year of being back at the farm and kind of in that spot in life when it's unclear what you want to do and you're kind of seeing people around you excel and work and find, you know, their path in life in a kind of direct way. And it just seemed funny to me that I was in this situation. I mean, it was a little sad too, but also, I mean, humor is a good way to, I think, shift the perspective of something like that. And it just so happens that my parents are humorous. I think they're kind of characters. They're both unique and they have a really, what I think of as a nice relationship, something that I probably took for granted when I was growing up.
Yeah.
So to be back as an adult and be around my parents and be around the farm where I grew up, again, something else I took for granted, which is the space, being around animals, I started to see everything a little differently. And so it's sort of a book about that, all of that in it. It's called One Bird's Choice. And then a couple of years later, I wrote a book, also nonfiction, about a minor, very minor road trip that I took with my grandma when she turned 92.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, so minor that it was, I basically just picked her up about 2 hours away where she lives and brought her to Kingston where I live. And we spent 5 days in my apartment, which sounds bleak and unfun, probably to most people, not in any way, the type of gift that I had offered her, which was an actual trip somewhere. And I kept it a surprise because I myself didn't know where I was going to take her. And I was worrying the whole time before the trip, like, what can she do at 92? Should I take her? And that's why after humming and hawing, I decided I would just bring her here. And it turned out to be a great thing because we had just time together and we talked the whole time and had meals and took walks. And so it was an amazing trip, unexpected. And because we had all that time, we talked and I ended up hearing so many stories from my grandma and I could observe her at that age. And I admired her so much that I decided I wanted to write about that and write about her really. And so I wrote that book and it's called The Truth About Luck. And yeah, it came out a few years after that. So I felt like I had written a couple books of nonfiction. And part of the reason for that was, for me, fiction is harder to write. Mm-hmm. I find it more difficult because you don't have, you know, with a nonfiction book, it's just reactive. Something happens that's real. And then you just react to it. Like if I was writing about this, you know, the water mug I have and talking to you, and I'm not making that up. So I can just describe it in a way that feels important for the story. Whereas if I was making this up, I'd have to make all these micro decisions to just to get to this point.
Yeah.
So it felt to me like I loved fiction. I liked reading fiction more, but I didn't think I was ready or able to try writing a whole book. I'd written short stories and stuff, but so it took those two books to kind of make me feel confident enough to even try writing a novel. And it was around that time that the idea for I'm Thinking of Anything came to mind. And I just kind of went for it and started, even though that was a very different kind of book than the first two. I just sort of started writing it and really enjoyed the process of writing fiction.
But that experience you had, the rural experience, if you will, farm life, that did end up being reflected in both of your first two novels, as I recall, just this the sense of isolation and what it's like to actually just... sorry, your parents were working farmers, is that correct?
Yes and no. I mean, it was more of a hobby farm,
right?
But we did have, you know, sheep and ducks and chickens and dogs and cats and bees and gardens. And so it sort of was a mix between the two, kind of definitely was the lifestyle of living on a farm. But my dad worked as well off the farm too. So it was a little bit of both.
And what did your grandmother do vocationally?
She was a nurse. And she was also had she actually was she had signed up to be in the army for the Second World War. So she actually was overseas with the with the troops during the Second World War. So not something she talked a whole, and she was an operating room nurse. So she saw some horrific things and, you know, didn't talk a whole lot about it, to me at least, when I was young, and I can understand why. But I was, you know, curious about that. And so that's something we talked a lot about on our trip together. She still remembered a lot, and I was fascinated by it and her outlook, how that would change her and how that would change her adult life coming back from being part of something like that. And so we definitely touched, you know, a lot on that, and then just on a lot of other things. I say she was someone who I always really admired the way she existed and the way she connected to people, even when she was well into her 90s. She was always interested in other people. She lived that way, I think, being curious and interested. And it's such a good example to not get too wound up in your own issues, but to still be, you know, interested to meet other people and learn about them. And she was always like that. So I wanted to include that and ask her questions about that. And it was nice because we had this time, and that's something I've kind of encouraged people to do now after having done it myself, is to, you know, if you're going to go on a trip with someone, sometimes it's nice to not over plan it and not have the whole schedule laid out, or, you know, the days allotted to something, because if you can have a meal that lasts 3 or 4 hours, it's kind of nice because you end up talking about things. And, well, kind of like what we were saying about writing, you go places you're not expecting, and you touch on things maybe you're not anticipating, and that's when you can really learn about things. So,
well, one of the reasons I was asking about some of this for background is I'm getting to that age where my parents are getting older, and we're now apart. I live in Alberta, they live in Ontario, and, you know, I worry about them a little bit and whatnot. And your story, We Spread, has a lot to do with elder care on the one hand.
Yep.
And how seniors are regarded. It's interesting hearing about your grandmother's background in medicine and the kind of physicality she encountered. The extent to which she encountered sort of the limits of what the human body can withstand.
Yes.
And what can happen.
Yep.
Just because there's a character in this new book. That is very much interested, it seems, anyway, in science.
Yes.
And medicine and what's going on. And again, I'm trying to be mindful of not spoiling anything.
No, that's okay. I mean,
let's start with the elder care part, because I think that is kind of, to me anyway, when I read it, I thought about my parents and I thought to myself, oh, I wonder if Ian's starting to think about what it's going to be like if and when his parents have to enter facilities like this. Because in Canada in particular, one of the major stories in the first year of the 2020 pandemic about COVID-19 was really a focus on these long-term care facilities and homes for seniors, and how poorly they were actually managed. And I suppose that's on a government level, like just how poorly they were subsidized.
Yes.
How poorly, I'm not trying to denigrate the people who work there, but
no, you're right.
Yeah.
The people who work there are amazing. Like that, from my experience, amazing.
Yeah.
Completely underpaid and undervalued.
Underpaid.
It's the government level that failed completely.
It was just such a huge part of the narrative. Like this virus is ripping through these communities and the people are not being taken through these, homes and centers and whatnot, and no one's really taking care of it. And in a way, and also it was sort of an accepted loss. So, oh well, they're seniors.
Yes,
they're just
exactly.
going to get this thing. What do we? Why we got to worry about everyone else? So they're really anyway. Sorry, Ian. All I'm getting at is
I think that's connected to the book too. Those
okay.
sort of themes, like
yeah. Go ahead.
Just the way we perceive elderly and aging and nearing death, and how we mostly fear it and kind of revile it.
Use value, productivity in society.
Productivity.
I guess where I'm coming from when I read this book is, and the timing of it is, Do you suppose any of that narrative stuff that was going on in the media and in your real life, your real experience and people of our age who are going through stuff like this, do you feel like any of that may have spurred you on to pursue a book like this one?
I mean, I think that's a really good question. But funnily, it is kind of funny in that I actually had kind of, I wrote most of this before the pandemic.
Oh, really? Okay. Huh.
Yeah. But it became even more relevant for me because of everything you just said.
Yeah.
What got me to start writing it was actually my own grandma moving into a care home. And when she, right before she turned 100, she had been living in her own house that she'd been living in since the 50s. And got to that point, she had developed dementia and it became a bit too much to be living there. So, you know, a care facility, a care home was found and she moved in, and my family, we obviously helped move her in, and we're spending a lot of time with her there. And that was my first meaningful experience, I would say, seeing somewhere like that. And I was impressed both by my grandma's ability to adapt and to connect with other residents, some who had severe dementia, connect in ways that almost how children might connect on a schoolyard, you know, and how she would interact with the staff. And I was so impressed with the staff at this facility. That's the other thing. The job is so demanding, working with elderly people, and it's something just culturally we don't value enough, and it's awful. And you know, they were so kind to her, and I think she connected with the PSWs and the nurses there, and the way she did with the other residents. But just that environment, just the idea of being at that stage of life, having any kind of cognitive decline and having to adjust to somewhere completely different, I was interested. So that was, in this case, it wasn't an image that I started with, but a setting. And I knew I wanted to write about that because I was so interested in it and thinking about my grandma living there. And that's how the story started.
So again, following the thread I was trying to tie between the kind of agrarian settings of your first two novels and also the relationship stuff,
mm-hmm.
which is always really fascinating to me, your interest in relationship dynamics. When people pick up this book, you will discover that the main character, Penny, is just haunted by the long-term relationship that she and her partner were in. So that part's there. Where I'm coming from in this little run of thoughts about what you just said is this seems to then be, if my previous theorizing is correct, We Spread is another product of you kind of taking nonfiction, real life stuff and trying to process it, if you will.
Yeah.
Sorry, that might be putting too much on you, but I think you do. My sense of you from my familiarity with your work and our conversations is that you do try to process the real world, the nonfiction world, via fantastical fiction.
Yes, and I would say more specifically, questions and ideas that I'm personally invested in, that I feel it, you know, that's something that I think has surprised me, is that all three novels I've written feel more personal than both of those nonfiction books. And
right.
I wouldn't have anticipated that, but it just turns out that any kind of fictional work that I spend time on has to feel personal. Otherwise I won't be able to do it. I won't be able to devote that much time or energy to it. And so it, I think not only are you right that I'm kind of starting from a position of being in the realm of nonfiction before I actually start delving into something that I make up, the premise is made up, the characters are made up, but what I'm writing about is real, and it's real for me, and it's things that I'm unsettled by, or I'm uncomfortable with, or I'm just unsure about, and writing about it is exploration for me. I'm never trying to provide answers for myself necessarily or anybody else, but I'm trying to have a discussion. That's what it feels like.
Can I talk about myself for just a little bit? Because I think I might be dumb, but I might be a dumb person. But here's what happened to me. As I said to you earlier, I'm into the second time through this book. And the first time, I'll just tell you what I'll just tell you something. First time I'm reading the book, I think of Penny, the narrator ostensibly and protagonist of this book, as a reliable narrator. And I'm reading and reading and reading. And as I'm reading, Penny is asking lots of questions in the prose of the book. Did I say that? When did I do that? Where's that thing I put? And and then but the whole time, what Penny's kind of getting at when I first read the book is something nefarious is happening to Penny in this home she's in, and people look different, and people, what's going on? They won't let us outside. Second time through the book, though, as I reread part one and thought about what she was alluding to, rather reading what she said. And then knowing what she would be, how she was going to, sorry, my second time through, I'm reading the part one and I'm like, wait a minute. She's saying a bunch of stuff that I know that she alludes to later in the book because I read it the first time. Then I'm like, wait a minute. I don't know if Penny's a reliable narrator. Does Penny have dementia? Right. What's going on with Penny? Because she is now going through her mind and her memories are coming to her in a discordant way. And she's saying things that she doesn't even know why she's saying them. Sorry if I'm blathering on here, Ian.
No, this is, in fact, this I will just
go ahead.
Say one thing about, because it is just, I mean, the idea that someone would reread We Spread is, I really appreciate that, because that's one of the reasons I try and make it as short as possible. I don't think about that again in the first draft, but as I get closer to revising a final draft, I end up removing chunks that I might like or that I might think are okay. But I do want people to be aware of the ideas and the possibility that they might be enticed to read it again, reread it. I think it's a totally different experience on that second read, and I myself love to do that with books, and so that's why I hope some people might, like yourself, might do that. And I'm never sure why we don't do that more with books. Like, we do that with everything else. We listen to music over and over that we love. We watch movies over and over that we love. But there's an idea with books that, okay, I've read it, I'm done with it now. And maybe because there's so many, it somehow feels wasteful to reread a book. But I really don't agree with that. I think it's every time you read a book and reread a book, it's different, you know. And there are books I have read 5-6 times, so.
I think those who listen to the show with any semi-regularity know that this is not the first time I've had an author on and said, I've reread your book. There have been occasions where I've read a book 3 times, and I've just sort of said it because each reading reveals something. You're absolutely right. Like, I've seen the movies Jaws and The Godfather a trillion times. Like, yes. Literally, probably. Like, I could not, if they're on, I'm done. That's, if they're on TV,
you're locked in.
That's my day. Yeah, I'm in. And I just, well, I not, and there's always something I pick up from it. Yeah. This book is one where I think, and your other books as well, like the second, third time through, whatever, you're going to be like, oh, okay. I should have saw that coming the first. It's one of those things where I'm like, you know, you said people think of it as a psychological thriller. I think it's because it makes them think things that they weren't expecting to think. It's less, it's almost less about what you've said. I mean, sorry, there's a chicken and egg argument there. You say or write a thing, and then our brains start going, like, I'm the one unsettled. If I was a different person, I probably wouldn't be.
But I like that.
I'm the one
who
gets,
that's how I mean, when I feel that as a reader, it's a great feeling. And it makes you want to stop for a moment and pause the narrative and think and reflect on what was just said or written. And again, that's what I think of as another beauty of books, is that you're in control of that. It's not dictated for you. It's, you can stop anytime you want and reread a paragraph or reread a whole page or just stop and reflect. And there is no rush in finishing a book. There's, you know, reading it at one's own pace is I think the right way to read. So I appreciate all that, you know.
And it's my pleasure. I mean, I gave myself a project with this podcast that brings me back to my school days, where it's I'm like, oh, I got to interview a musician. I'm going to listen to their album 50,000 times before we talk, so it's at the ready. If they say something, I'd be like, oh yeah, you said that in song 9. Similarly with your book or authors, I try to reread books. Let me go back to my original train of thought, though, because where I was leading us initially was this seems to be a book about elder care and maybe what we think is going on in such facilities is different than what is actually going on. Second time through, I realize it could be still be that. There's something not right there. But also, this seems to be a meditation on cognitive decline, on dementia, mm-hmm. on disorientation. Are mm-hmm. both things possibly true from your perspective?
I think from my perspective, I would say it's closer to the second, you know, reading that the context, the setting is of an elder care home. But I was less interested in writing about that than I was about writing about those things you just mentioned and ideas of what I feel like is a cultural obsession with youth and trying to stay young and a fear of aging and a fear of getting closer to death and just a fear of death in general and wondering why that is. Why isn't it that we, as a culture, we don't value aging and value mm-hmm. getting to that, you know, being appreciative of that point in life? That's what I was really interested in, and using my own my grandma as an example, she was someone who did get to that. She was fortunate enough to reach a stage of life that is elderly. She was 102 when she died, and she was never scared. She got to that stage with such grace that I feel like it was a great example for me, and she wasn't overthinking it. She seemed appreciative to be there and was always happy to be around her family and friends who were around her, even as her dementia worsened. And I appreciate that. I like that idea that it's not something to fear necessarily getting older, that there's certain value that comes with that, that we lose certain, usually, not always, but usually physical things, but there's so much other value that we often don't include when we're thinking about these things. So I was really interested in just why that is, and combining that then I think with advancements in technology and in healthcare and the certain emphasis we place on that, and what you mentioned earlier, being productive, and that's where value is supposed to come from. And that's not just for any particular age. I think that's across the board. That's sort of our mentality. It doesn't seem right to me necessarily, and especially in the context of art, which is what Penny is interested in. So all these threads, I think, were in my mind as I wrote. I was finding out things about Penny and the context of where she lives and her life, and I started to try to thread these things together into a kind of cohesive narrative that hopefully people can interpret and pull from what as they see fit, you know, and what becomes relevant for them.
Well, I appreciate what you're saying about the I don't want to misspeak, but the overemphasis on youth, certainly as it relates to the elderly. I appreciate what you're saying there, but there's a section in the there's a segment of this book where Penny is pondering an offhand comment that she hears one of her fellow residents talking about, which is in the realm of immortality. And there's this sort of manic more and more and more and more and more segment. And I think there's also this weird premium placed on immortality, that the notion Yes. that life shouldn't be finite. And I think Penny's philosophy is like, yeah, we're not just worker bees. We're not just like, maybe these lives should end, you know, maybe this isn't just, why would we all want to do this forever, you know? And that's
exactly,
that's a hard thought to have. But also if you're scared, like you mentioned, your grandmother wasn't scared. I don't think that's the case for Penny. I also will slightly tangentially say, as much as I have come to this conclusion, like, wait a minute, my narrator isn't reliable in my second time through reading this book, you did make the setting really creepy. You did, Ian, you took the time to make everything around Penny seem, again, now I'm like, is it creepy or is it just Penny's perception of it being creepy? But there's a lot of stuff that goes on that is really weird. And if you trust Penny, Because that's what happens when people go into cognitive decline. You stop thinking of them as having agency and coherent thoughts. So you're like, oh, you thought you saw something. You thought you did something. Yeah, you didn't really do it. And then you discount everything they say. So I think there's a lot of this swimming around in who to trust, who not to trust, who's the reliable narrator, who has honest intentions here. I'll tell you, I'm Team Penny. But I also, can see how this topsy-turvy landscape you've created isn't solid from anyone's perspective, like from any character's vantage point.
It's not, and I think that is for a number of reasons. One, it kind of reflects Penny's own interest in art and the type of art that she likes to make, which is she's a surrealist, and so that also has a part in the story, I think, and kind of bleeds into the narrative, her own interest. And I think what you said about her view of getting older and being that we're kind of, our value is in how productive we are and also trying to extend life unnaturally, maybe, that she comes to understand that in a different way by the end of the book.
Yeah.
In a way that I myself align with too, as I was writing it. And I think she does see how the idea of life and death being very similar, and that you kind of need the fact that death is this inherent piece of life for everybody, actually gives it meaning. And if you somehow took that away, some people might think, oh, that isn't that great, but it in fact would seem to me to be literal hell. And I think Penny comes to a similar conclusion, I think, in the story.
Yeah, I want to leave. Like I said, I wanted to make sure we tiptoed around this a little bit. I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah,
I just want to leave the book behind in a sense and say, you know, congratulations again and thank you again for putting these thoughts down. I will say before we completely leave it behind, on a structural level, in terms of your practice, again, I didn't revisit Faux. And I'm thinking of ending things again. I think the last time we spoke, I told you I read Faux, and then I had to reread I'm Thinking of Ending Things. I think that's what happened, because I was like, wait a minute. Yeah. These are I found connections between them. Do you stylistically feel like this seems sparse to me, particularly sparse, and particularly it's affecting because it's so sparse. I think it's very direct. Does it feel like a departure for you, or an experiment, or something you've done differently?
I think a little bit of both. It always probably for me feels slightly different than someone else. I think stylistically there are things that I tried to do differently just for my own interest. And I never want to feel like I'm totally developing one kind of aesthetic or going down a path I've been before. But I think, of course, saying that, there are things that are similar to the other books stylistically. And I think, you know, it's almost like just having a voice that's yours and without it being intentional. And so I do see that too. And I think a main thing being that I probably am a sort of minimalist in my writing.
Yes.
I think partially that's because I'm writing about ideas and I want people to think about those ideas. And maybe if I can do some work for them by removing some excess, that it makes that part of it easier, because, you know, I could have written all three of these books and they each could have been probably 200 or 300 or 400 pages longer. I had, you know, if I had gone that route, but that's asking then way too much, I think, of a reader to kind of go along that far and try and retain everything and put pieces together. And so to me, that's why near the end of a book, I will always spend time reducing almost the way you would like a sauce on a stove. And because I want it to be almost like a spoonful, you know, you can have the Thanksgiving meal. It's an amazing experience. I love that. But having just a beautiful sauce on one spoonful of it is also equally pleasing at times. And I think those, you know, there's the reading experience. That's like The Big Dinner, which is a 500 page novel. And I like those, but there's something, again, I think if you're going to invite people to come back, you wouldn't sit down and have a second Thanksgiving dinner right away, but you would come back for another spoonful of that delicious sauce maybe.
Yeah.
And So I think that's part of the reason why these books are quite short and hopefully readable and hopefully feel kind of urgent as you're reading them, that you do want to keep reading, because I also think the fewer sittings, the better. You know, if you're reading a book and you're putting it down and you're reading it for 10 minutes at night before bed for a month or something, it's kind of hard to form an opinion on it. But if you can sit down, if you get some time and you can sit down in 3 or 4 hours and plow through a novel, it's a nice feeling, and you just end up retaining so much more of the story and the ideas.
No, that's well said, and I appreciate that. While we're on the topic, as we're speaking, there's a lot of chatter about the book industry, particularly in Canada. How are you feeling about just the state of your field? Because there's book mergers and companies coming and going, and a real reckoning, feeling like this isn't working. Like, this system here does not support the people making this stuff. You've had great success, I would say. I mean, one of your first book was turned into a Netflix thing, and you worked with Charlie Kaufman. I mean, who's got that? Foe, I think, was also
The movie for Foe is finished shooting and is being edited right now and will come out sometime in 2023.
That's really unusual for someone to not only have their book picked up, but to actually be made into things. You've had your first two novels were optioned and they did stuff. All I'm getting at for people listening is Ian, from my perspective, doing quite well. But there are people in your same sort of your contemporaries who are struggling. And like I say, and I don't know what you want to say about it, but we're talking about stuff. What do you think?
There's lots going on, and I think from the side of it of, you know, getting film adaptations, there's so much luck in that too. Really, yes. I mean, there's so many good books that, you know, someone may not, it might not end up in the right hands, or. And in the case of I'm Thinking of Anything, Charlie happened to read that book, and then something about it appealed to me, wanted to make it a movie. So that's just luck, you know.
Sorry, we got to tell this quick story again, because you told me what happened with Charlie finding your book. Can you quickly tell folks what happened if they missed it the first time?
Yeah, the book came out, and my agent had been sending it around to some producers, and I was not thinking anybody in the movie world would be interested in this book. It's quite philosophical and just strange, and you know, a lot of it takes place in a car, so it doesn't scream cinema. But there was a couple producers who called, and I never felt like they were going to lead to anything. And I didn't even really find them overly enjoyable. They seemed like they didn't talk about any of the ideas of the book, or so it didn't seem like it was kind of going anywhere. And that's sort of what I had anticipated, and then you know, out of the blue, she got in touch with me one day and said, oh, you know, next week, would you be able to, do you have time, I guess she said, to talk to Charlie Kaufman? And I remember looking down at my desk, and I have this like desk calendar which was literally blank, like there wasn't one entry for the whole week, and I said, oh yeah, I think I can, you know, find time to talk to him. I was a big fan of his, so I was just thrilled that he had even reached out to the agent to you know, want to have a talk. And it was great. He was so generous and kind, and I could tell right away that he was the type of person that I like. And we talked for about 10 minutes about the book, and then for about 50 minutes we talked about a variety of different things, including music and movies, and it just kind of, you know, progressed from there. And at some point I had asked him, you know, did the agent send it to you? And he said, no, you know, it was like Amazon recommended it to him based on his previous purchases, or some algorithm had, you know, and thankfully he bought it and read it. And so I'm not exaggerating when I say so much of that part of it is luck. And, you know, it's like books winning awards, or, you know, that's comes down to a panel of three people and they make a decision. And so, you know, other books that are amazing that I read that I love, they don't seem to get attention, and you wonder why. And I do know that I think the Globe and Mail is reintroducing their book section, I've heard.
Oh, good.
This fall, so that's very exciting. There, you know, even 10 years ago, there were several national book sections in newspapers that seemed to be thriving. And
yeah, I used to review books for the Globe and Mail, and then it stopped.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly, and so that would be good. And I just think one good thing that I think is happening, it seems to me, is that we're hearing from more voices in Canadian literature, and there's an emphasis placed on that from, I think, publishers. And I mean, that's clearly a good thing, that, you know, the work itself is going to be better if you're hearing from a variety of different people and a variety of different experiences. And so that's something I think that seems to me to be overdue and a good thing. And I, you know, I think as far as from the, you know, the business side of it, I don't know enough about it even. Like I do feel like I'm kind of outside of that world, and maybe that's ignorance, and but I've so much I try to just kind of think about is my the work that, you know, that I'm working on, and I hope people read it, and I hope they like books that are kind of different and that they can maybe discuss, or and I try and do things that are a little different, and maybe that won't be to everyone's taste, and but it does feel fortunate, lucky that there's a publisher kind of willing to put it out in the world and promote it, and so I'm grateful for that. And but definitely you just kind of feel from book to book. I think it's similar to music. You know, you just never know how people are going to respond, and mm-hmm. you're appreciative of any kind of attention and response, and then, you know, you kind of move on to the next thing. So
yeah, that's fair. And I didn't mean to put you on the spot with it. I just wanted your perspective.
No.
Some of our mutual colleagues have been a bit more like, finally, some changes need to happen, and people are finally talking about them. So that's
which
good.
I think now, that's really good. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're talking about We Spread, which will be out as people hear this. It's due out at the end of September 27th, 2022. What's next for you? And do you have plans? Have you started working on a new work or anything like that?
Well, yeah. I mean, I have a few things on like that I'm working on that are pretty early. The faux film adaptation that I co-wrote the screenplay of will be coming out in 2023, so I'm excited for people to see that. Still no firm release date set. We Spread is actually in development now for film.
Wow.
And I'm co-writing the screenplay with a director named Minhal Bag, and she's brilliant, and it's been fun working with her on that. So that, you know, hopefully there'll be some news on that front in the coming months. And then just a couple other little projects I have that I'm starting up. And those, as I said earlier in the chat, sometimes those go places and sometimes they don't, depending on kind of narrative momentum. So, I'm just kind of plugging away, working away. I enjoy working, and it's been fun to do things in the film world a little bit, because that I've always liked, you know, I've been a fan of cinema, but never thought I would work in it. I feel... I wasn't trained in that world or anything, so it's fun to get some opportunities to just try stuff, and the next few years, hopefully I'll be doing kind of a variety of different things, and just, yeah, it's, we'll see what happens. But it's, I appreciate chatting with you again, because I'm a fan of your podcast. I listen to it all the time.
Oh, thanks.
And I really appreciate how you talk to people and, you know, veer in and out of the work, and just the way people themselves are thinking and the culture at large a little bit, and also how you talk to, like, you talk to a lot of musicians but also writers, and there aren't many places who are doing that. So I mean, you talked to one of my dear friends, Alex Weird Nightmare, earlier this year, and I love listening to that episode, and so I appreciate what you do, so it's
thanks, Ian.
That's why it's nice to talk to you.
No, I really appreciate it. Before we wrap up though, is it too early to talk a little bit about the cast and crew for Faux? I know some of that information is sort of out, but is it too
early? No, that's all. I mean, so it's, I co-wrote that with Garth Davis, who's an Australian filmmaker, and he directed a movie called Lion about 5-6 years ago. So he co-wrote it with me, and he's directing it. And then the cast, Saoirse Ronan is playing Henrietta.
Oh, nice.
And Paul Mescal from Normal People is playing Junior. And then Terrence is played by Aaron Pierre. He was in The Underground Railroad, I think, last year. And all of them were, I mean, I'm biased, obviously, but they were, I'm so impressed with their performance. I never realized kind of what went into acting until I would see actors work. And
you were on set. Were you on set for chunks of time?
Yeah, and I was on I was on set for a bit during I'm Thinking of Anythings too, which was really my first time.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to see an actor come onto set as themselves and, you know, interacting with the crew. And then all of a sudden they snap into it and now they're a character and it's them. Like you see this transformation and then they cut and they do it over and over and over. And it's just something you have to kind of be there to appreciate. Right. So the acting info is something I'm really excited for people to see. And just that they're all good people, I think that's something I've always, you know, feel, again, grateful about. But, you know, you hear stories of people ending up maybe working in that world or the film world. But everybody, both that I'm Thinking of Anythings and info, and so far and We Spread, they're just really nice people, kind, have been good to me. And that's almost more worthy, I think, of feeling happy about than the work itself. So I hope to continue that too.
Well, I just want to say I'm very happy for you, and just given how long we've been sort of interacting, I'm proud of you. It's very exciting, your success. So I just appreciate it, and I appreciate your giving me any time. I really do. This book is out via Scout Press. It's called We Spread. It's out September 27th. Ian, if people want to learn more about you or follow your exploits, if you will, where would you like to send them?
I do have a Twitter account, which is just Reed, my last name, underscore Ian. Ian is with two I's, I-A-I-N. So that's probably a good spot to go. I'm going to maybe throw you for a loop. One request, if I could have, to somehow, I don't know if this is possible, but to end, when we end this chat, which has been really enjoyable, I would love it if you could play a little Weird Nightmare to go out with, because that's my guy.
And
I think that's
guy.
That one of my favorite records of the year, and I hope people are listening to it and enjoying it. And so if there's any way we could throw a little bit of that on at the end, you know, I would certainly appreciate that.
I'm sure that can be managed in a permissions way. I'll send notes to the respective people. Do you have an actual song pick? Let me put you on the spot.
I would say Searching for You, just because that's the one that I think that was the first single, and I think I know a lot of people that I've, you know, recommended the album to have mentioned that track. So let's say that one if it's possible. And if it's not, I understand. Either way, I got a little plug in. So
no,
I'd love for people to hear it.
I'm gonna throw to it right now. Yeah. And if you don't hear it, it means some went haywire, everyone. But we think what's gonna happen right now is you're gonna hear from a great record that came out this past year by Weird Nightmare. This is Searching for You, as requested on the record by Ian Reed, one of Weird Nightmare's friends and mine. We're mutual friends. So, yeah, let's go out on that. And I think an appropriate band name for some of what goes on in We Spread. Let's segue it that way.
I was going to say, it's I think, just an appropriate thought for people who might consider picking up We Spread. Absolutely. I think it fits. So
okay, Searching for You by Weird Nightmare. Ian, this was really a pleasure for me. I hope you enjoyed it, and best luck with everything, and I hope we talk soon.
Thank you very much. I always enjoy it, and I hope to maybe see you actually in person sometime before long too. So thank you again, and thanks everybody who picks up the book.
So I wanna take Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, we did it. We got some weird nightmare on the show. Thanks to Alex Sedkins and the fine people at Sub Pop Records for saying that was okay. That was Searching for You from the self-titled Weird Nightmare album, as chosen by my very special guest, Ian Reed. Ian, thank you so much for returning to the show and all your kind words and for all your great work. It's unbelievable. And in this case, for those of you listening, Ian is on the 719th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available just about wherever you get your podcasts. If you can't find the show or an episode that you're looking for, or if you want to learn more about me, sign up for my monthly newsletter, please visit vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook and follow the show on Twitter at vishcreative, or you can follow me directly on Twitter and on Instagram at vishkana. Also, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to keep this podcast going. That is the primary source of revenue. $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive archival content, bonus content from these fresh interviews when I have time to go overtime with the guests. Also, you get the episodes just a little bit earlier than everyone else if I can get it done in time. Of late, it's been out hours earlier, you know, 7-8 hours before everyone else gets it. Usually the day before is what I'm saying. It just depends on my production schedule. But yeah, that's a perk. Anyway, $6 or more a month grants you access to all that. And you can change that amount anytime you want. You can lower it. You can raise it. You can go as high as you want, as low as you want, really. So anything you can do to help the show is appreciated. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt, just message me on Patreon once you've made your contribution, and I will get you a t-shirt just as soon as I possibly can. We'll exchange messages. It'll be fun. Patreon.com/creativecontrol. Thanks again to Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee, all fine establishments in Guelph, Ontario, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton, Ontario, for their in-kind support for this show. Thanks to my old friend Jim Guthrie for lending me some music on the show. You can learn more about Jim at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Ian Reed. I urge you to pick up all of Ian's novels. We Spread is the latest one, and it's wonderful. I hope you enjoyed our conversation about it, and it piqued your interest without ruining the book. There's a lot going on in the book, so check out that book, and please subscribe to this podcast if you don't already, or follow it or whatever, and tell your friends all about it. That helps spread the word about the show, and that's all I got to say. Thank you so much. I will talk to you very soon. Take care of yourselves. Bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50,
luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.